Happy New Year, and welcome to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM in Toronto and CFBU 103.7 FM in St. Catharines. I'm your host, Daniel Angrenon. Today we'll be looking back at some important news, interviews, and music from the past 12 months. It has been a very busy and exciting year for our team, so to start things off, I would just like to thank everyone on the team that has helped make this year possible. First off, to Taylor Book, who has done a fantastic job as our new producer on top of keeping all of our social media sites updated, Lauren Corman and Aaron O'Sullivan for co-hosting the show with me and putting together some amazing interviews, Neil Harvey, who has done wonderfully at redesigning our website, making it a lot more sleek and user-friendly, and writing the blog posts for the episodes, along with prepping the shows with Aaron, Marilyn Mativia for helping Neil and Aaron get the shows ready for our archive and podcast, Justin St-Ange, who let me use his studio in the summer, as well as did the teching and editing for those episodes, Rob DiTilio for designing our new logo, Kevin Tillman of the Vegan Hip Hop Movement for giving us music to play on the show, and of course our listeners, especially those who have generously donated to our show in our biannual fundraising drives and helped us stay on the air. For today's episode, I'd like to start and take a moment to mention past host Carl Orzechowski, who we have been lucky to have on the show a few times. He participated in the Open the Cages tour with Jenny Bundock and Mike XVX, who we also interviewed early on in the year, and I also had a great discussion with him about rodeos during the Calgary Stampede. Here we have a clip of Lauren's interview with Carl around the beginning of the year about his new film Maximum Tolerated Dose, powerful approach to understanding vivisection through the eyes of experimenters who chose to walk away.
So you were pretty close to this material for a long time. I'm wondering about your own story, like the things that really lodged in your chest and kind of the sorts of observations that you made and what it meant to bear witness and then also to create an art project that would move other people. Like what has stayed with you most from making the film and some of those stories?
The biggest things that stayed with me were definitely the aspects of the film that I filmed myself. So the film is kind of a mixture of, there's a lot of found footage, old archival material. There's also archival material that I received from the BUAV and a couple of other places where that sort of fills out some of the things visually, but there was a great deal of the film that was filmed, you know, on location by myself and a couple other people. And I mean, our investigative work in Laos when we were investigating monkey farming there obviously really stays, like every kind of investigative work that I've done has really stayed with me in a pretty profound way.
So what was it like?
Doing investigative work is weird because you can't have a break. Like, there's no, I'm going to take a bathroom break and be myself again. You have to really, you step into a character while you're doing what you're doing, and you have to do what you have to do to get the material that you have to get. So while we were, myself and a couple other people were doing this investigation, I was the lead investigator and was, you know, I was pretending to be an animal dealer. The story was that I needed some monkeys to supply for a film, and then those monkeys and then subsequent monkeys were going to be used in a laboratory. And the film aspect of that story allowed us to bring in cameras, you know, to convince people to let us bring in cameras and shoot very, very high quality footage of the places that we were able to visit. And the laboratory aspect of the story helped us to get evidence of what was being done. And that I, after that investigation, I also compiled a report for the BUAV that was then used in some international meetings that they were a part of about trapping and breeding and that sort of stuff. So, yeah, I mean, I don't like lying to people. I don't like leading people astray, and I don't like that aspect of it, but you know, my accountability in those situations is not to them. It's to the animals that are stuck there.
Can you describe what you saw?
So in the sequence of the film that I'm talking about, it's the fourth sort of chapter in the film. And it essentially shows the life cycle of what a macaque monkey would go through from being trapped in the wild of Cambodia or Thailand or Malaysia being bred in massive farms in Laos and then being laundered, and monkeys are laundered essentially in China because there are rules about their import and export. They're sent to China and Vietnam where they're given, you know, new paperwork and new identities. And then there's from those Chinese and Vietnamese companies, they're sent off to the West and increasingly to places like India where research is being outsourced. In the monkey farms, it's kind of like what you would see at any kind of factory farm. You know, you're talking about long buildings. They have cages on either side, and the cages are a standard size. For the monkeys, the cages were, I'm terrible at estimating sizes, but I would say maybe, you know, 15 feet cubed, you know, 15 feet in either direction. And they would probably hold, I don't know, 25 or 30 monkeys each. And the monkeys were, it depended on the farm. I personally visited three different farms, and those different farms had various states of care for those monkeys. But, I mean, the one thing they all had in common was that those monkeys came from the wild. They were trapped for pennies, essentially, given to the trappers. They were put in those, you know, forced living conditions with other monkeys who may or may not have been a part of their original families or social structures. And then they were used for breeding to create as many as possible in as little as time as possible. And then those groups would be separated, tagged, and, you know, sent all over the world. So that's, and I mean, that's before they even get into a laboratory. So just being witness to that aspect of the industry, the breeding and the trapping aspect of it, added a new dimension for me, and I think it'll add a new dimension for people who watch it as well. There's also some footage from a dog breeding facility. I think when we think about animals in labs, a lot of the time we think of them in labs, you know, and we think of them maybe with some like cartoonish image of a vivisector over top with a scalpel and looking all evil, but that's not what their lives are like for the most part. You know, for the most part, their lives are like, they don't start where we think they start, and they don't really end where we think they end either.
The next clip is from an interview with Laura Broxton of the National Animal Rights Association in Ireland. For those who may not have heard, Laura recently won a court case after being assaulted at a protest she was attending. Here's an article about it from November 29th about the incident. This comes from the Irish Independent newspaper, and the headline is, "Furrier ordered to pay €9,000 damages after punching animal rights activist." A furrier, who punched and injured a young woman during an animal rights protest outside her shop, has been told to pay the protester €9,000 in damages for personal injury arising from the assault. Judge Matthew Deary proceeded with the claim of Laura Broxton, 24, in the absence of the defendant Marie Murphy, furrier of A Store Is Born, Clarendon Street, Dublin. He had been told that due to a breakdown in communications in the office of the solicitor representing Ms. Murphy, she had not turned up for yesterday's hearing. Judge Deary decided to go ahead with the case when barrister Anthony Lowry, for Ms. Broxton, said Ms. Murphy's solicitor had been served on November 1st with a notice of the trial, and this was the third time the incident had been processed through the courts. He said Ms. Murphy had been convicted in the district court and this had been overturned in a circuit court. It was unacceptable that the court should be told at the last minute that she now did not know of the civil trial. Ms. Broxton, of Dublin, told the court that when she was 18, she set up NARA, the National Animal Rights Association. On December 19, 2009, she and a number of animal rights supporters had been protesting with posters and handing out leaflets outside Ms. Murphy's store in Clarendon Street when the assault took place. Ms. Murphy, shouting and angry, had come out of the shop and shoved and punched her in the face, knocking her to the ground. She received injuries to her lower lip, left knee, and arm. Psychologist Dr. Tony Bates told the court he saw the incident as he walked past the shop. Ms. Murphy had come out very red and enraged and hit Ms. Broxton in the face, knocking her down. He'd kept walking but had given evidence in both of the earlier court hearings. Several of Ms. Broxton's fellow protesters also gave evidence of seeing Ms. Murphy assault her. Judge Deary said the protesters had not been blocking the entrance to the shop, and there was an independent evidence from Dr. Bates of Ms. Murphy having come out in a very aggressive fashion. Ms. Murphy was upset that the protest was taking place outside her premises, but she was not entitled to assault Ms. Broxton as she did. He also awarded court costs against Ms. Murphy. So here's our clip with Laura, and she talks about some of the successes that her campaign has had in Ireland.
Are you planning on reusing the same process that you did before, or are you hoping on attacking the issue at a different angle considering you have a new government to address?
We're going to try and use new tactics. Like before, what we did was we had an undercover video put together. We went around politicians sending packs, talking with governments, went around all the towns that have fur farms, protesting, collecting petitions, and creating awareness about the issue. And we're going to do all of that all over again. But this time, what we're going to do is, in addition to that, is we're going to focus on protesting the industries involved in this. Much like, I don't know if your listeners are aware of the SHAC campaign, Stop Huntington Animal Cruelty, in the UK and the US. They focus on companies involved with the industry they're focusing on. So, for example, we'd like to get the company that gives them the carbon monoxide to stop giving them carbon monoxide. We'd like to get the people who transport the pelts to stop transporting the pelts. So we'd like to make it very difficult for the industry to continue, in addition to our protesting, outreach, and government lobbying.
Yes, from what I found on your website, it seems like there have been a lot of successes in getting these tertiary targets to stop supporting. Would you be able to talk, elaborate a bit more on your successes during this campaign?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, one of our biggest, most successful campaigns in the country was our fur campaign. I mean, years ago, Dublin used to be full of shops selling fur, and one by one, we got them all to adopt fur-free policies. Now, there's still three shops in Dublin that sell fur, and they're furriers. That's all they sell. They own their premises. They're not obligated to respond to directors of any company or chain. So they don't really care that we're there. It's more of a hobby to them. But on high street stores and big chains, we were able, with protests and lobbying, to get dozens of shops to stop selling real fur. So at the moment, there's actually very little fur for sale in the country at all.
That's actually so cool. And I think I read somewhere, like, there's a, I forget if you said it's gone through or it's on its way, but the idea that Dublin is, like, going to be a city that sells real fur, is that correct?
That's what we're trying to do. With Dublin City Council, we've already gotten the council to ban fur within its fairs and markets, and any event it is having, fur is not allowed to be sold, which is great because there was Dublin City Council fairs like Viking fairs where they used to use real fur, wear real fur, sell real fur, and all of that is banned at the moment. And any public council-owned land, you're prohibited from selling fur now. Unfortunately, it doesn't apply to high street shops or chains at the moment, which is why the three furriers left still exist. But we're hoping, with enough lobbying, we can get an import ban on fur, which means they will not be able to sell fur because they will not be able to buy it. So that's our long-term goal, to get Dublin City Council and the government to get an import ban rather than just a council jurisdiction ban.
Another notable event of the year was the success of the film Blackfish, directed by Gabriella Cowperthwaite. The film has been met with rave reviews and has been changing the way that the public is seeing SeaWorld. After the interview aired, it was also in the news that many musical acts that had been hired to perform at SeaWorld cancelled after watching the film or learning about animal captivity. This goes to show the importance of tactics such as tertiary targeting, which played a major role in the decrease of SeaWorld stocks. And as SeaWorld scrambled to improve their PR, the public became more educated about the true nature of captive marine animal parks. Here's our clip with Gabriella.
Would you be able to tell our listeners about, like, what some of these things are that SeaWorld is telling people that are not true?
Yeah, the longevity is a big one. Obviously, SeaWorld, they have their people there at SeaWorld trained to say that animals live longer in captivity than they do in the wild. Which is just like, oh my gosh, you know what I mean? Like, you're going to go that direction? It's just patently false. You know, we know that the males can live up to 50 and 60 in the wild, and females 80 and 90. There's even reported females out there who are 100. They live comparable to human lifespans. And yet in SeaWorld, they die in their teens and their 20s. And there's a couple outliers who are a little bit older than that, but for the most part, just the mortality rate there in SeaWorld and in sea parks is 2.5 times greater than it is in the wild. So, you know, again, people just look this information up. SeaWorld's been getting away with this fact for a long time. another one of the calf and mother separations. They say this happens when the mother has rejected the calf or done something bad to the calf. And number one, they separate the mothers and the calves for entertainment purposes. Maybe that calf is disruptive to the mother while she's trying to do a show, just like the terrible twos, like toddlers, can be disruptive. And so they move the calf to another park. Maybe another park needs a baby Shamu. That makes a lot of money to bring a lot of visitors into a certain park that might not be doing that well. Or breeding purposes, shifting calves around and separating families for breeding purposes is the reason. And they say it's only for the safety of the calf or something ridiculous, because clearly when you separate the mothers from the calves and so forth, the animals are grieving. And trainers who have been there and heard that and watched that, it's one of the things they don't ever let go of. Again, the ones who stay there usually talk themselves out of it and tell each other, people tell you all sorts of stories about why this is necessary. But, you know, any trainers we've ever spoken to have said it's just a terrible thing to behold. So the list goes on. So many untruths are spoken in those parks or just lies. And it's not even lack of education, it's miseducation. They're deliberately telling you falsehoods. So it's something that we scratch the surface on in the film.
Yeah, definitely. And so I was wondering if we've sort of talked about the trainers a bit, if we could move on to the whales themselves. You know, I've never been to SeaWorld myself. Would you be able to describe the conditions of SeaWorld in comparison with the wild?
Oh, that's a good question. I'm not really great at either end. I can only kind of talk about what people have told me, since I never really worked at SeaWorld and I've never been a, you know, marine biologist in the wild. But, you know, you just imagine all the room you have in the ocean and the infinite amount of variables hitting you at any one given time. You know, killer whales are just built to react with speed, with agility to all these different variables that the ocean can provide. You know, whether they're echolocating on this thing or they're swimming fast over here or catching sea lions or bonding with family members. I mean, nothing can compare with the ocean. Then balance that against being in a concrete pool, which is just these finite walls, and swimming in circles. I mean, if these animals are supposed to be swimming up to 100 miles a day, and they're swimming just in circles here, logging and floating on the surface. Logging is sort of when they just sort of surface rest. They get stung by mosquitoes, which Jeff Ventry and John Jett, two of the former trainers, have done extensive research on and basically say that this has caused them encephalitis at times, or West Nile virus, or things that were passing through these tropical regions at the time and killed them. You know, so this giant kind of masterful beast is killed by a mosquito because it's surface resting in a tropical environment where it shouldn't be. And they're just there with unnatural pods. So in my head, I guess I always thought, at least the whales have each other. I guess back when I first started the documentary, I thought, well, at least they have each other and they can kind of bond with the other whales there. And to learn that that wasn't true and that there's actually tremendous social strife, because these animals don't even speak the same dialect oftentimes. They're just mixed and matched here and there. And they're constantly vying for hierarchy with each other because, you know, in the wild they vie for hierarchy, but then the subdominant animal can leave and swim away and say, touche, you win. But in captivity, nobody ever gets to swim away. So they just are confronted with conflict all the time. I mean, that's just, come on. Like, that was a tough one, I think, for me to swallow, was just to be in a, you know, adrenaline-charged, stressful situation day in and day out. It just sounds pretty miserable. So yeah, there's just no comparison, SeaWorld pools versus ocean.
Before we continue on with some highlights of interviews from the past year, I'd like to make some announcements for our listeners at Brock University, the University of Toronto, or the area in general. For our listeners that are in or around Toronto, there is going to be a series of animal rights lectures taking place every Thursday from 7 to 9 p.m. in room 507, located at 100 St. George. And this is going to be every Thursday, starting from January 16th. And it looks like they've got a really great lineup of guest speakers. The next announcement comes from Brock Students for Animal Liberation. They would like to extend an invite for anyone who is interested to join the Smash Vivisection Selfie Project. From their Facebook page, they say, "Here's to making 2014 a more caring and compassionate year." Rock Students for Animal Liberation is calling on all students, faculty, staff, concerned citizens, and animal allies to engage in some online activism with a big impact. This is an action that you do on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram to let Brock University know that you are distressed that animals are being exploited, tortured, and killed on this campus. What to do? 1. Make a sign expressing your disapproval of vivisection at Brock and or asking that Brock University end vivisection. Express yourself creatively and how you would like, but use common sense, i.e. don't make any threats. And in your text accompanying your picture, include a relevant hashtag and tag Brock University for this to work. 2, take a picture of yourself holding the sign. And 3, post it on the Facebook event page and on your own profile, and if you have them, on Instagram and Twitter. You can also send a photo to their email at brockanimalliberation@gmail.com. And if you go on to the Facebook page, you can also find out more information about vivisection, both at Brock University and in general. So I hope that some people can check that out and send out some selfies. On the topic of universities, another guest that we had this year was Kendra Coulter. She came onto the show to talk about the work done with and by non-human animals based on a course she's teaching at Brock University. I also figured this might be a good chance to take the time to mention any of our listeners who are interested in animal rights and liberation as an academic field, that this is just one of the many courses at Brock University that focuses on non-human animals in various departments, including visual arts, philosophy, political science, women and gender studies, and of course, the critical animal studies concentration and minor program in the sociology department, which includes courses taught by our very own co-host, Lauren Corman. So stay tuned for this clip with Kendra Coulter.
Well, and I'm really glad you brought that up, because I think one of the sort of points of contention between, I think, animal rights activists and those who say that animals are workers, right? There's this sort of idea that any work that a non-human animal does would be forced work, because you can't literally ask for their consent, even if it's a really fantastic job like a seeing eye dog or something. You don't necessarily know that that dog wants to be there. But on the flip side, there's a lot of jobs that are very positive for animals. And I was just curious, where would you draw the line, for example? How do we know what is forced work and what is not forced work?
It's hard to generalize, and I think that we need to be open to nuance and to different particulars. And, you know, you mentioned seeing eye dogs, and we've had two guest speakers, two and four-legged, come into the class, and one of whom was a police dog, and the other was Farley, who works with Therapy Tales here in the Niagara region. And it is very hard to argue that Farley hates his job. Mm-hmm. Farley's this big English sheepdog who meets with kids, and they make connections between bullying of humans and animals, telling his story. And so he is very, it is very difficult to argue that he is unhappy. In fact, he seems extremely joyful and delighted. Mm-hmm. And so there can be differences among species. Within species, there can be differences as well. You know, biological dimensions could be causing pain, or personalities. Animals are unique individuals just like humans. And so some are very interested in doing particular kinds of things. Others are not. Yet others will say, I don't feel like doing this today, but maybe tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, to use horses as an example, there's a lot of arguments that some of the great, famous, successful show jumpers, you know, one of whom was named Hickstead and from here in Canada, his rider and those around him argued adamantly that he knew what he was doing, that he was quite conscious, he was quite aware of what the tasks were, and that he expressed a great deal of agency in terms of awareness of the competition and awareness of shaping the relationship that he had with his rider, Eric Lamaze. And so I think that it's important to identify situations of exploitation and slavery and enslavement, but also for well-intentioned people not to inadvertently deny animals their own agency and recognize that in a work relationship, perhaps the animal did not choose to be there in the first place, but is very much shaping the nature of that. And again, an extension of that is recognizing that if we need jobs, right, and we can critique the problematic jobs, but simply critiquing them is going to exacerbate divisions between people. It's going to exacerbate tensions and the disconnect between groups of progressive people who might be able to find common ground. And so I think it's important to approach these issues thoughtfully and recognize that if we're going to try to move things away from problematic work towards better work, that this needs to be done in a thoughtful way. But we also need to talk to people who are engaged in the work themselves. And I mean, I know Lauren Corman has talked to some slaughterhouse workers, for example, who say, you know, I'm poor and this is the only option that I have and I wish I had something better. Mm-hmm. And that's a common story that we hear. So there's a way to approach this that's nuanced and thoughtful. And sometimes it requires us to suspend our expectations and our assumptions about people and try to bridge ground that, you know, perhaps animals are going to be used in work situations. And so let's work with people who work with animals themselves to try to foster mutually beneficial relationships.
Our next clip comes from an interview that Aaron did with Richard Ryder, as she learns the story behind how he came up with the word speciesism. It's a really cool idea, and I think it really kind of touches on the basic principles of speciesism and why it should be such a common sense word that we recognize in our vocabulary.
So tell us the story specifically of the term speciesism. I seem to recall it having to do with a pamphlet and a bathtub.
Yes, I once told someone I was lying in a bath when I thought about it, which is actually true. I take showers these days, so I don't have so many good ideas. But I was just lying in my bath in a house near Oxford in, I think, 1969 or 70, and I was thinking it was a shame that all the liberation movements going on at that time, human rights, women's liberation, a lot of concern about debunking social class, all these movements were going on, and I participated in them, but I felt they hadn't yet touched upon the other species. And I wondered why this was. It just seemed to me that the whole image of animal protection at that time seemed to be wrong, and people thought of it as a bit sort of dotty and peculiar. And I thought, well, they ought to be thinking really in terms of why does a species difference justify so much moral oppression and injustice? Because I don't see that it does justify it. And so I was thinking we need to really start talking in terms, I thought of speciesism, just rather like racism or sexism. We've got to get the message across. We must think in terms of speciesism in order to make it clear to people that it's a prejudice as stupid and as unjustified as racism or sexism. It's all about physical differences between groups of suffering individuals when these physical differences are morally irrelevant. And that's the point I wanted to make.
At the time, were you actually in a psychology department?
At that time, I was actually working for the psychology department at the Warnford Hospital in Oxford, where we were treating psychiatric patients.
So you mentioned that the idea of speciesism got a fair bit of traction, but how did your colleagues react? And how also did the people in the other movements react? Like you said that you were interested in other social justice movements. How do those two groups react to this notion of speciesism?
You know, I don't think to answer your last question first, I don't think the people in the other movements particularly reacted as a group. They certainly didn't. I didn't have people writing to me saying we are the campaign against racism, we agree with you or disagree with you. That didn't happen. What happened was that various people sort of popped up in Oxford who were interested in the idea. Two things happened. I started writing letters to the newspapers, and these were mostly attacking animal experiments, which I'd seen at Cambridge University. And one of the people who replied was Bridget Brophy, who was a well-known British novelist at the time, the late Bridget Brophy. And she wrote and said she approved of what I was saying. And did I know Stanley and Rosalind Godlevich and John Harris, who were also living in Oxford? And I wrote back to her and said, I didn't know them. And she put me in touch with them. And Stanley and Ros were, and probably still are, Canadians. And they were young philosophers at Oxford University, and they were already thinking about the subject. And so we got together as a group, and Stan and Ros, I think it was, actually managed to get one of the big publishing companies in London, Gollancz, interested in publishing a collection of papers, of essays, about the relationship between the human and the non-human animals, or non-human species, I should say. And they invited me to write one of the chapters about animal research, which is what I did. And that's where I think, first introduced the word speciesism in a book. So that was one of the good outcomes of what happened. The other was that I wrote a leaflet in 1970 called Speciesism, and had it privately printed and circulated, first of all, in the town of Oxford, and got very little response. And then I circulated it around the university colleges in Oxford and got one or two responses. In fact, one of the people who received it was a young graduate from Australia called Peter Singer. And he got in touch with me and came out, and we had tea together on three or four occasions at my house and talked about this idea of speciesism. And I'm very pleased to say that he agreed with me, because remember, I was a psychologist and not a philosopher. So I felt if I could get a professional philosopher to agree with me, that was reassurance that I wasn't completely crazy. And we formed a good friendship then, and we're still friends now.
Recently, I had the chance to talk with Doug Niesloss of the Bears Forever Project. For our next clip, Doug shares with us a story that he's had while giving tours around the Great Bear Rainforest and some of the interactions that he's had with bears, as well as, unfortunately, with the hunters that are killing bears in the Great Bear Rainforest. And you can learn more about the Bears Forever Project at bearsforever.ca, and be sure to check out the video Bear Witness.
We are nearing the end of our time, but I was just curious, you know, you mentioned that you were working in the tourism field for quite some years. Do you have any personal stories about yourself and some of the bears that you've seen?
Oh, yeah. A lot of stories. I guess I started guiding back in 2000 and mainly doing grizzly bear tours, black bear tours, spirit bear. I've had the opportunity to take people all around the world, and people come here to come and see bears. And, you know, to me, this is the last area, the last stronghold for bears is the British Columbia coast, or Canada in general. You know, you can see a lot of bears. So I think for us, it's always been very important. But, I've had I've had a lot of close encounters with bears, and, some very positive. And, the one thing that made me really sad, though, was the hunting. And I remember back when I first started guiding, I found a dead grizzly bear floating down the river, and his paws were cut off, and his head was cut off, and his gallbladder was taken. And, that just made me really sad, that why someone would come here and do that, it didn't make any sense to me. Then it was a few years later, I was out in this one estuary, and I spent about 5 or 6 weeks with this one black bear. And this black bear was living in an area where there was grizzly bears. And normally, black bears don't do too well where there's grizzly bears. And so anyways, I went in there, and it seemed like every time I got into this river, this one black bear would get really excited. And as soon as he knew that people would go there, he would feel safe. He can come and eat his fish and bring his fish right in front of us and eat his salmon. It was really amazing, So we really got to know this bear, and this bear had its own personality, and like every bear does. And just really, really were able to bond with it. And as soon as we left one day, we had another boat. We passed another boat, and all these guys were all dressed in camel gear, and they had tripods. And I thought, are those hunters? And I said, no, it can't be hunters, because they were in an open boat, and, where I live is quite remote. And so I thought, there's no way there's any hunters up, this far north. And so those guys had gone in and shot that black bear, and they shot another grizzly bear, and they broke into our cabin and had these dead bears laid out in our cabin. And that's when I just, that really made me upset that, these two industries are in the same area, and it just proved to me that they can't exist. So I decided to get more involved around the bear hunt, but also realized that, I didn't really have a strong voice as a tour guide, even though I was seeing those things out in the field, that I had to get involved more in the political arena. So it's a big reason why I decided to join the political arena and become more of a voice for some of these animals. And, unfortunately, a lot of these things go on, but a lot of people just don't know about it. So we're going to help people, whether that's through documentaries or different types of studies. And that's one of the biggest training points for me.
That's all the time we have for today. You can find all the episodes that have been played or mentioned today on our website at animalvoices.ca or on iTunes under the College Radio channel. 2013 was a very busy year for Animal Voices. We made a lot of changes with our logo and website and building up our team. I'm looking very forward to 2014 as we continue to grow even further. Thank you once again to our entire Animal Voices team. And please do not hesitate to contact with any questions, comments, or show ideas at animalvoices@gmail.com. And be sure to check out our Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr pages. Stay tuned for Animal Voices next week, where we have a brand new episode with Victoria Moran of The Vegan Mainstream. Thanks for listening.